Today I want to talk about you and you. Actually, both of you. You and your ego. Your ego would try to convince you that you're someone other than who you really are. So, that's who I want to talk to. You versus your ego. It appears that we all have egos pushing us into certain behaviors. We have naturally occurring ego drives that affect how we think, how we feel, speak, and how we act. We are also connected to and influenced by divine intent. Think about the ego's influence by considering how much you think about others and how much you think about yourself. I bet we could test 0 to 10 how much we think of ourselves in various contexts, and I'm a fan of the 12 worlds as a structure. Spiritual, mental, emotional, physical, family, career, financial, social, leisure, community, political, and maintenance. And look at how you think of yourself or those other people or things in each of those worlds. One way to look at it is in this process is to view it kind of like determining our degree of self-consciousness. The more self-conscious we are, the less other-conscious we are. It's an indication of where we're putting our attention. In parties during the holidays, we can say, I'm going to go to a party. And when we go to the party, we'll have a sense of who we're paying attention to. Our own feelings, you know, do I have spinach in my braces, my fly zip, do I have my hair combed correctly, do I have the right makeup on, am I dressed appropriately? All of that stuff is an example of self-consciousness. As preparation for, say, a meeting or a party or an interview or a presentation or a date, it pays to be self-conscious enough to validate our preparedness. We'll go through a checklist of sorts to be sure we're ready, maybe standing in a full-length mirror to make sure everything is okay, our wardrobe is put on correctly, everything is adjusted, hair combed, and so on. And that's good preparation. Norman Vincent Peale used an affirmation as a pep talk before he came out onto the pulpit to speak. That got him ready. That was the focus of his preparation. And this is what he said. I love my audience. I love my audience. I love my audience. And he would repeat that over and over again with increasing fervor in order to get him excited and energized and to change his energy field because he was an incredibly shy person in reality. And then he'd step out onto the pulpit and you could just feel a tremendous outpouring from yourself to him of love. It was amazing to be in church when he was preaching, and I used to go into Manhattan specifically to hear him preach. I remember talking to another speaker who told me he did an affirmation as a pep talk before he made presentations. So I said, what do you say? And he said, my audience loves me, my audience loves me. I say it over and over again. That was the end of our conversation. The ego wants us to get and to protect ourselves and to protect what we got. So, as we acquire this stuff, the ego says, well, I'm keeping it no matter what. It's pretty obvious that if we get there first in any activity, we will pretty much have our pick of the best. If you were to walk up to the buffet table and you're the first one there, guess what? You have the greatest choice. If we arrive last, though, to that buffet table, whatever it happens to be, could be a metaphorical buffet table, the availability of the best could be very limited. Man, everything is picked over. There's not much left here. All the fill in the blank is already gone. As our ego drives us to be better than everyone else in every area, the striving for energies that can create the feelings of being best is intense. The lengths to which an ego-driven person will go can be astonishing. They can say and do things an average, normal human being wouldn't be able to. It's like, wow, that's unbelievable the way that person speaks and acts. I can't do that. In a recent conversation with a man who has considerable kindness and considerable cruelty, I suggested to him that he was actually the person who was kind. The cruel person wasn't really him, although he believed it was. That aura of cruelty is self-protective. He must imagine that cruelty keeps people away from him, and by doing that, it keeps him safer than if he allowed people to get close to him emotionally. He also must believe that using brute force in pretty much every situation is the best way to make what you want happen. Sounds like a bull in a china shop, right? A lot of the problematic power of the ego comes from the beliefs that we, as individuals, are alone, and we alone can meet our needs. This thinking leads to an us-against-them mentality. You see it all the time. And this thinking is easy to believe if we only use our five senses to interpret our experiences. Imagine that your version of God has provided certain things, including your existence. Just that single sentence requires you to confront where your life comes from and what you are. If you can accept that the life that is you has to have a source, then seeking to understand and experience that source more fully, more completely, makes a lot of sense. If your version of God has advanced from the child's perspective of a big white man with a beard in the sky, maybe in a cloud, then you may be ready to consider that God is actually consciousness, and so is everything else in existence, consciousness. The difference between a doorknob and a doormat, between a dog and a donut, is the vibrational frequency of that consciousness. You may believe that you are a skin-covered bag of consciousness showing up as water, bones, muscle, and blood. Like a drop of water in the ocean, you may be individualized as a person, but still a part of all consciousness, which in this case I would call an ocean of God. As the drop in the ocean and the drop of water is in the ocean and the ocean is in the drop of water, we are in the ocean of God and the ocean of God is in us. No matter what we do or don't do as humans, we are in the ocean of God and the ocean of God is in us. That's what we are. It's easy to look at various bodies of water, oceans, sounds, bays, and lakes, rivers, and notice that many are polluted. Toxic materials have been dumped into the water, making it dangerous to people. Think about Flint, Michigan, because Flint, Michigan is an example of a city whose water has been poisoned for profit. The drop of consciousness that each of us is similarly polluted, at least to some degree. Energies have been added to us that distorts our awareness of our connection and relationship to the divine. Our ego's job is to maintain our sense of individuality by protecting us, keeping us secure and alive, and working to make sure our needs are met. Our ego wants us, tells us, how important it is to be comfortable, to have convenience, to have gratification. The problem, when only the ego is influencing us and not our divine connection, is that we come to believe that only we are important and not others. Not other people, not other things, certainly not the planet. When we act in the extreme to the ego's four driving needs, we run into problems. Not only do we diminish our receptivity and openness to divine influence, we activate the same ego drives in other people. And then the competition that is increased can increase to the point of savagery in others and in ourselves. The nature of God, I'll say divine consciousness, is to provide for our well-being by supporting our growth, our nutrition and nourishment and nurturing, our healing and repair, our protection, our fulfillment of need, our work, our survival. And rhythm that describes the movement of energy is provided, all of which are governed by the law of cause and effect. That is, we reap what we sow. We can create. We do it whether we want to or not. We are creating. Now, is our ego creating? Or are we, the real us, creating? As these divine flows move through us, and all of creation, not just us, all creation, the divine is working for us, in us, and through us, to the extent that we are aware, that we are open and allowing of it. Because we're electromagnetic, just like everything else, we have the powers to bond and the power to reject. To demonstrate this, play with two of the magnets you have on your refrigerator by pushing them together and then reversing the positions and try pushing them together. You're going to notice that bonding is very powerful and rejecting is very powerful. Both can be life-enhancing and both can be life-destroying. And that's the crux of the problems in our lives. What do we bond with and what do we reject? The ego. You don't want the ego to be in charge of making all those decisions. You, the real you, want something, and the egoic you wants something. The question of, is this something I want influenced by me, the real, divinely connected me, or by my ego that only thinks of me and disregards others? The answer to that question becomes clearer by noticing the types and degrees of bonding and rejecting involved in the process of getting what we want. I was driving a car in warm, sunny Boca Raton, Florida. The roads are in perfect condition, not a pothole anywhere. However, I found myself judging and criticizing other drivers, rejecting them for no valid reason. They weren't interfering or endangering me. I was just rejecting. That is the ego at work. I suppose it wanted the roads empty for me with only green lights to speed me on my way. If that is what my ego needs to be happy when I'm driving, it isn't going to let me be happy very often. Over the years, I've had acquaintances who were really decent guys until they got behind the wheel of a car. I have three such extreme examples flashed into my memory. One occurred in Texas on a business trip, one in Costa Rica, and one on Long Island driving into Manhattan. All three men acted as if they were insane, maybe in a chariot race, driving as if their lives depended on them getting somewhere really, really fast. These men were not themselves. They were dangerous to me, the other passengers in the car, themselves, and other people on the road. If they weren't themselves, who were they? They were their egoic them. Rejecting the ego, though, is not the answer. I bet all or almost all human suffering is due to rejection. While it looks like bonding with heroin is the problem of a heroin addict, I see this as a symptom of a previous rejection. I don't see the heroin as the problem. I see what came before that as the real problem. And I could make a case for that addict hating themselves or their feelings. And the use of heroin is the attempt to escape the pain of those feelings. If the addict would cease the rejection of self, I believe the need for and the use of heroin would stop automatically. Studies have shown that soldiers returning were in Vietnam had easy access to cheap, high-quality heroin, and a huge number were addicted to it. And when soldiers were returning to the United States from Vietnam, it was feared that they were returning as addicts, and they were going to cause a tremendous societal problem due to their addictions. Experts didn't expect or predict that the soldiers would stop the use of heroin once they returned to the United States, but that's exactly what happened. I suggest the change of environment and the change in how they saw and felt about themselves enabled those veterans just to stop using the heroin on their own without outside intervention or involvement. Consider the ego's four driving needs to be like gravity. You don't want to get rid of gravity, and you don't want to get rid of the ego's needs. We manage gravity in our daily lives. Just think of that. We manage gravity in our daily lives. We know it's there, and we've learned how to move in that reality where gravity influences. And that's what we're called upon to do with the ego. We do want to maintain our individuality, but we can know that we are not our possessions, we're not our status, we're not our fame, we're not our bank accounts, and we don't have to go to extremes protecting ourselves from criticism, emotional, or physical attack. We can learn that coming in first in the race of life is actually a competition between who we are at that moment and who we want to be in the next moment. And this need doesn't require us to diminish others, to suppress them, to hurt them, or to kill them. Belief in scarcity is a denial of reality. People only believe in scarcity if they have a lack of awareness. With awareness, we can know that we are enough and we have enough, and enough exists outside of us, available to us. The ego, though, would have you believe in scarcity and the need to push you to overcome scarcity. There are troubles with this belief, one of which is that it strengthens the electromagnetic energy field to repel evidence of abundance. We do amazing things to convince ourselves that we and our beliefs are right, even if doing so hurts us. So now we believe in scarcity. Here comes abundance. I believe in scarcity. And we repel it. We reject it. We push it apart electromagnetically. Another trouble, and there may be way more than just two troubles, is that no matter how much abundance you see or you have, your belief in scarcity will make those amounts of abundance not enough. If you feel you are not enough, and there is not enough of what you want, you are being handicapped by your ego. Here's a third problem. Your ego will scold, push, berate, and otherwise punish and drive you, often painfully, to do more, to acquire more, to take more, to protect more, and more, and more, trying to fill an ill-defined need that can seem like a black hole. No matter what you do, gotta do more. No matter what you do, you gotta do more, you gotta have more, you gotta buy more, you gotta take more, you gotta earn more. On an individual level, our happiness, or lack of it, is probably a good indicator of whether we are in control of our lives or our ego controls it. This should be very simple to assess. Are you happy? Look at your life in various areas and ask yourself that question. Are you happy? If you want a more precise assessment of how much ego force controls your life, you could use a list of characteristics provided in Christ Returns Reveal Startling Truth in the beginning of letter 6. It says, If your present consciousness is permeated with love of possessions and an inability to share with others, devising ways and means to become rich at the expense of others, stealing, failing to perform your work conscientiously or give good value for money, snapping, snarling, indulging in criticism, sarcasm, judgmentalism, rejection, denigration, enmity, intolerance, hatred, jealousy, aggression, violent impulses, thieving, falsehoods, double and devious dealings, slander. You are ego-driven. Your ego is in control, and you will find it difficult to move through the miasma of ego consciousness to be able to see reality. Sounds like I was just describing a elected official in the United States, didn't it? What is the solution? The solution is simple. I don't mean easy, I mean simple. Trust in the divine. This is what Jesus discovered in the desert after being baptized by John. The creative power we call God is only love, nothing but love. Not judgmental, not punitive, not vindictive or wrathful, not preferential towards some people and opposed to others, not demanding obedience, only love. When he understood this loving power is working for us, in us, and through us for our complete well-being, he set off to teach these truths to his people and everyone else who would listen. We have a chance to be reached by his teaching if we will just listen and allow, which is going to result in our growing sense of trust in the divine. I would like to end this service with a prayer. And when you listen to this prayer, you might say, wow, if I could believe this prayer, my trust would skyrocket. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.